Good day, and welcome back to Decolonization le Vietnam, aka the history of Indochina. Last time, we parted ways in 1802 when Gia Long unified the territory between the Chinese border and the Mekong Delta and dubbed his new kingdom Vietnam. However, this kingdom would disappear before the end of the century. Let's see how. If you ever have the chance to visit Paris, there are many museums, but there's one that I'm interested in today. It is the Museum of the Paris Foreign Missions, Les Missions Étrangères de Paris. The MEP, as it is known, is a Catholic missionary organization dedicated to missionary work in foreign lands. Well, these guys have a museum, and in this museum is a painting of Prince Can. This prince was the son of Gia Long, and he was sent to France by his father along with the bishop Pignot de Béarn, whom we talked about briefly last week. You may remember that back then, Gia Long, who's not yet Gia Long, was still Nguyen An, and he was fighting to get his kingdom back from the Tyson brothers. That's why he sent his son with the French bishop to the court of Louis XVI to seek military assistance from the French. But to understand how this bishop, Monseigneur Pignot de Béarn, happened to be in a position where he was offering his assistance to the future Gia Long, we need to step back and talk about the Catholic presence in Vietnam. Catholics have been present in what is now Vietnam as early as the 17th century, when Jesuit priests were expelled from Japan and landed in the Red River Delta of the Dai Viet Empire. The Jesuits were more successful in Dai Viet than they were in Japan. And by the middle of the 17th century, there were around 200,000 to 300,000 Catholic believers in Dai Viet, which was very significant if you consider that there were about 8 million people at the time. Most of the new Catholics were from the lower classes and the peasantry, of course. But there were instances where elites converted to the new faith. A sister of the Trinh Lord, for example, and remember the Trinh were the ones who held power in the north, and some scholars as well. And we already talked about one of the most brilliant scholars of the 19th century, Nguyễn Truong Tho, who was a Catholic. And the most important legacy of the Catholic present in Vietnam were the invention of a Romanized transcription system of the Vietnamese language. This system was invented by a Jesuit, Alexandre de Rhodes, in 1651. And by the way, allow me to be pedantic and to say that Alexandre de Rhodes was not technically French. He was indeed born in Avignon, a city that everybody knows is in France, but Avignon back then was part of the Papal States. So, there you go. Well, this chap, Alexandre de Rhodes, had a lasting impact on Christianity in Vietnam, and on Vietnam as a whole. He wrote the first trilingual Vietnamese-Portuguese-Latin dictionary, and the writing system he invented would play a predominant role in the spread of nationalist ideas in the 20th century. And nowadays, that is a national writing system in Vietnam. Fast forward to the 18th century, and hundreds of European priests were in Dai Viet, like Monseigneur Pignot de Béarn. In 1777, during the years of the civil war between the Tyson and the Nguyen lords, the Tyson brothers attacked Saigon and eliminated almost the entire Nguyen dynasty. Nguyen An is then 15 years old and managed to escape into the far south and took refuge in Pignot de Béarn's seminary. Pignot did not take in the prince out of charity. He purposefully sided with the future Gia Long and thus took his side in the civil war that was taking place. That is why Dalong's son went with Pinho de Behen to Versailles to ask for Louis XVI's help. The child prince and the bishop arrived in Versailles in 1787, and they even managed to sign a treaty between Louis XVI and Dalong. But this was 1787, folks, and we were nearly at the point where Marie Antoinette was advising the riffraff to eat brioche. Okay, that might be a legend, but you get where this is going. Louis XVI had other things to worry about, and he never fulfilled the commitments he took towards Dalong. However, you must give credit to Pinho de Behen. He didn't give up, and he single-handedly raised funds to participate in the future Dalong's war effort. He even recruited French volunteers to fight for his ally. Pinho de Behen's assistance did not tip the scales towards Dalong, but it was significant enough to earn him the gratitude of the emperor. And during his 20-year reign, Dalong was very tolerant towards foreign and native Catholics. But everything changed with his successor, Minmang, from 1820 to 1841. Dalong had done all his fighting before gaining power. After being emperor, he did not expand his empire significantly, and he relied mainly on many local lords who were loyal to him but basically ran the show in their area. When Minmang inherited the throne from Dalong, he did everything differently. First, he launched an aggressive colonization of Cambodian and Laotian territories to the point that his empire kind of looked like the future French Indochina. Secondly, Minmang centralized the power exclusively in his hands. He imposed Confucianism as the only acceptable belief system. And that's why he mercilessly persecuted Muslim chams, Buddhists, and sought to bring all these numerous local lords under his control. And God knows there were many of them because of the turmoils of the civil war before Dalong took power. So these guys did not like the aggressive policies of the new emperor at all, and they resisted these policies, sometimes with weapons. So there were a lot of people dissatisfied with the new emperor out there. What made it worse is that Minmang drive happened at a time of significant economic difficulties. So, as a result of Minmang's political takeover on one hand, and of the economic difficulties on the other hand, there were more than 4,000 revolts between 1800 and 1858. The most dangerous revolt against Minmang started in 1833 in the southern part of the empire and in the fiefdom of a former general of Dalong. The son of this general was a guy called Le Van Khoi. Khoi rallied behind him everybody who was dissatisfied or had beef with Minmang. And let's name a few. Chinese and northern settlers found it very hard to do business the way they liked it. You had court officials who did not like the new ways. And you had Catholics who were not happy that religious freedom was now curtailed. And you add to that ethnic Khmers and Muslim Chams who were being killed or displaced. Le Van Khoi took the lead of the revolt with two objectives: overthrow the emperor and secede from Dainan. And as a result, six provinces revolted, threatening Minmang's dream of centralizing everything. The emperor sent shock troops to teach this upstart Khoi a lesson. But it took those troops around 2 years to put down the rebellion. And when that was done, oh boy, the repression was merciless. For example, one day in Saigon, 1,200 men were buried alive. Another example, A French Catholic missionary, Father Marchand, had his flesh pulled from his bones by tongs, an ordeal known as death by a thousand cuts. The Catholics, like Marchand, were only one component among others of the revolt led by Lê Văn Hoài. But they were the most numerous faction, and Minh Mang went after them very hard. So from 1835 onwards, the Catholic community in Vietnam lived under permanent persecution. Their faith was banned, and they were killed left, right, and center. After Minh Mang's death, persecutions of Catholics occurred as well under his successors Thieu Tri and especially Thu Duc. And this will be the pretext of the French intervention. You see, the missionaries, and many of them are French, were either victims or witness to the plight of Catholics in Dinan. They sent dramatic letters and accounts of the killings to France, and it was not rare to find the horrors suffered by the Catholics in Dinan on the headlines of French newspapers. And all this was happening in the first half of the 19th century, at a time in France after the fall of Napoleon, where conservatives had the wind in their sails. During the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty, for example, between 1814 and 1830, French Catholicism became more militant, and it stayed politically active as well during the Second Empire, which was led by a very Catholic monarch, Napoleon III, and his very Spanish Catholic wife, Eugenie. As a Catholic monarch, Napoleon III used the unrelenting repression of the Catholics as a pretext for the French intervention in Dinan in 1858. I say pretext because it is not really the cause. Of course, Napoleon III was a Catholic sovereign, and he had intervened in Lebanon in 1860 and even in Korea in 1866, also under the pretext of protecting Christian minorities. But the real reason for the French intervention must be sought elsewhere. First of all, Napoleon III wanted to compete with Great Britain by rebuilding the French colonial empire and restoring France's prestige. For that purpose, he participated in the Crimean War, 1854-56. He stood alongside Great Britain in the Second Opium War with China, 1856-1860. And he even initiated an expedition to Mexico, which ended in a disaster, but showed that he was serious. He wanted to make France a world power like the UK. The Brits were already in Singapore and Hong Kong, and they controlled access to the massive Chinese market that everybody was crazy about. So the French felt they needed to get into the action before it was too late. And the main goal was, of course, to have access to China. Second reason, Napoleon III was convinced that colonies could be an outlet for French manufacturing exports and a provider of raw materials for the metropole. And he was completely in line with the banks, the insurance companies, and all the industrialists who at the time were pushing for a more aggressive form of capitalism. Lastly, Asia was just the place to be back then, and everybody was going for it. A few examples. The India Act, transferring all of India to the British Crown, was signed in 1858. And at the same time, the US was sending warships to force Japan to open trade. In a nutshell, to understand why France sent troops into the territory then called Dinan, you must think of the three C's: Catholicism, commerce, and civilization. Catholicism is the pretext. Commerce is the real reason. And we will get to civilization later in the program. The French conquest itself happened in two phases. A first phase from 1858 to 1870 roughly, and then another one starting around 1875 to 1885. First, in 1858, the French landed in Da Nang and proceeded to occupy the southern part of the Dai Nam Empire. They signed the Treaty of Saigon in 1862 that granted France 3,000 provinces. Then, in 1867, the French decided to annex 3 more provinces because, hey, why not? And let's note that at that time, Dai Nam, as I said last week, was a tributary of China. But the Chinese emperor was unable to help his vassal because China was then dealing with the Opium War. In the 1860s, though, the French conquest was put on hold when Napoleon III's regime started its decline. The Second Empire ultimately collapsed in 1870, and as a result, the French did not push their advantage further in Dai Nam. After 1870, what happened is that the French Navy and the admirals based in Saigon took things in their own hands without referring to Paris necessarily. They took it upon themselves to explore the Mekong River, and they realized that it was too difficult to reach China that way. So what did they do? They turned their gaze northwards towards the Red River Delta. And in 1873, a French Navy officer called Francis Garnier reached Hanoi and stormed the citadel. However, Garnier was killed in the fighting that ensued, prompting the French and the Vietnamese to enter negotiations. A second Treaty of Saigon was signed in 1874 between France and Dai Nam. With this treaty, Dai Nam avoided the colonization of all its territory, as France gave back all the cities conquered by Garnier in the north. But Dai Nam was forced to recognize French sovereignty over all of the southern provinces of the empire, which became the colony of Cochin China, or Cochin Chine in French. After 1877, the French Third Republic was established and the political scene in France became more stable. And one of the achievements of the Third Republic that is sometimes overlooked is that it established many French colonial possessions, including Indochina, Madagascar, Polynesia, and large territories in Africa. At the helm of this expansionist colonial policy was a guy named Jules Ferry. Ferry is very famous in France because he was a promoter of secularism, and he made primary education free and compulsory through several new laws. But Ferry was also a promoter of colonial expansion, hence his nickname Ferry Tonkin. And his motivations were the same as Napoleon III, money and prestige. Prestige because after suffering a traumatic defeat against the Germans in 1870, the new Republicans saw colonial expansion as a way to make France great again. And here comes the third C as a justification of colonial expansion, civilization. Ferry and people like him believed in the French mission civilisatrice. In other words, that France had the duty to bring civilization and enlightenment to inferior races. This was contested in France itself, and we don't have the time to go through what Georges Clemenceau said, for example, but Ferry and the partisans of colonial expansion prevailed. So when another sailor, an officer named Rivière, occupied Hanoi in 1883, under the pretext of rescuing French merchants taken prisoner by the local commander, Ferry backed him up 100%. He committed the French government and sent troops to Dai Nam. This time, however, China came to the rescue of its tributary. And just like that, war erupted between France and China in the territory that is now Vietnam. The war lasted from 1883 to 1885. the Chinese and these people who are not yet Vietnamese, but whom I call Vietnamese because it's simpler, tried to resist the French steamroller as much as they can, but they were just outgunned. No less than 5 treaties were signed between the French and the Chinese and between the French and Dai Nam to end the war. The reason was that the monarchs of Dai Nam saw the treaties as a way of stalling and slowing down the French conquest. When they were losing, the Vietnamese would sign a treaty they thought was temporary, and it gave them time to regroup before going on the offensive again with China on their side. But what the Vietnamese didn't realize was that they had entered a death spiral. The French were there to stay, and they would not relinquish what they had conquered, and their military superiority was overwhelming. We have precise accounts of the fighting because, in part, a famous French writer, Pierre Loti, was then an active duty officer, and he witnessed, for example, the Battle of Thuan An in 1883. He described it as la grande tuerie, or the slaughter in English, in a series of articles published when he got back to France and for which Loti was dismissed from the Navy. The following is a quote from one of the articles that I translated in English, and a warning, it is gruesome. Quote, "It was a kind of watering, which covered them all in groups in a splash of sand and gravel. And then we had fun counting the dead. It could well have been 800 or 1,000. The sailors discussed it, even made bets on the quantity. No one left to kill. So the sailors, with their heads spinning from the sun and the noise, left the fort and went down to throw themselves on the wounded with a kind of nervous tremor. They finished them off, stabbing them with bayonet, smashing their heads with rifle butts." End quote. So anytime you hear that an area has been pacified, anytime you hear that a treaty has been signed, well, there were massacres like the one we just described behind it. There was afterwards one treaty with Dai Nam in 1883 and another in 1884. In 1884 as well, France signed the first Treaty of Tianjin with China. And that was when the French burned the seal presented to Tsar Long by the Chinese Emperor in 1802 and which represented Chinese overarching rule over Dai Nam. However, hostilities resumed in 1885 with the Tonkin Affair, which brought down the Ferry cabinet but did not stop French conquest of Dai Nam. The fighting continued until a second Treaty of Tianjin with China was signed in 1885, and this treaty marked the end of the line for Dai Nam. China pledged to withdraw its troops and no longer intervene in Dai Nam. It recognized the treaties between France and the Vietnamese Emperor, and in short, the game was up for Dai Nam. France was already in control of the south, and after 1885, it occupied and imposed the protectorate on the central and northern areas of Dai Nam. After that, there were skirmishes between France and Chinese mercenaries known as Black Flags here and there. And there were the skirmishes with ragtag groups tacitly supported by the court in Hue. But organized resistance to the French was over. And one main reason why organized Vietnamese resistance was over was the chaos that engulfed the court when Emperor Thu Duc died in 1883 after 31 years on the throne. The period in the Vietnamese court after that is akin to the year 69 in Rome when 3 emperors were killed in 1 year. What happened in Dai Nam after Thu Duc is that 2 mandarins were regents and were pulling the strings. They got rid first of the first successor of Thu Duc after 3 days. After that, they forced the second emperor to commit suicide when he signed the treaty establishing the French protectorate. The third emperor was in power for 8 months before he died under suspicious circumstances. I wonder what happened there. In the end, the two regents placed a 13-year-old prince on the throne. His name was Ham Ji, and we are now in August 1884. Ham Ji and his two handlers took a stand against the French and revolted, but their movement was quickly and savagely put down by the French. And this time, the French army went so far as entering the capital Hue and ransacking it. One of the regents then escaped with the young Emperor Ham Ji, marking the beginning of an insurgency movement dubbed Help the King. In response, the French replaced Ham Ji with another prince, Dong Can, and put him on the throne instead. And with the reign of Dong Can starting in 1885, Dai Nam no longer existed as a sovereign state. France divided the territory in three: the colony of Cochin China under direct French administration, and two different protectorates, Annam in the center and Tonkin in the north, controlled by France via a king with no real power. And if you add to those three territories the Cambodian and Laotian conquest, we did not have time to talk about them, well, you have French Indochina. And the only threat to the new French colony were the 13-year-old King Ham Ji and his handlers. So let's call it a pod now and stop there. In the next episode, we will talk about French Indochina itself. We will cover the years between 1885 and roughly 1920, years where the French built a colonial state with no room for native national claims. Whether they were collaborating with the French or resisting them, the native Vietnamese population would never be really integrated into the Republic. And that's why things will go pear-shaped in the colony. So, thank you very much, and I'll see you next time. Until then, take care and goodbye.